A great movie, met by the young generation of Malcolm X Community Center.
Do you actually believe yourself that you can call up the devil and all his works?
Yes, I do indeed. Oh, indeed I believe. I have no doubt at all. But I do think that it's a very rare thing.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Twenty years after the Princess Diana panorama interview, what do our whistleblower spooks say about her death? And talking of cults, fanatical loyalty, control freakery, vast wealth going back centuries, while the peasants begin to starve around the castle walls. Is the British royal family a cult? That's what dying Australian Diana assassination author John Morgan believes. And he should know, he escaped from one. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. An annual commemoration day at Colston Girls' School. Charter day for the merchant venturers. Just within a few days of each other, hundreds of schoolchildren bust into Bristol Cathedral to listen to Bishop Mike's secret sermons, whilst the parents are locked outside, waiting in the cold. Some call it enervating for the soul. Others, indoctrination. And on Tuesday this week, the merchant venturers did it all over again, just as they've been doing for hundreds of years. The annual Charter Day service closed to all but the Bristol school children from schools the merchant venturers control. And the installing of a new master follows up at Merchants Hall in Clifton. This year's master is Tim Ross, a company lawyer from the City of London. So who's he? Well, to discuss some of this, I'm joined by Christine Townsend in the studio here. Hi, Christine. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
Now, I think you're standing for mayor as well.
I am, yes.
We've had two candidates on this show. The campaigning seems to be hotting up well before the election next May. But anyway, just give us an idea of why you decided to go up to see the annual commemoration day at Colston Girls' School. I think it was this time last week, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was this time last week on the Friday morning. It was very rainy, which was a bit disappointing. Last year, you and I know what was going on, and that what was being said to the children in the cathedral was
well. That's
exposed.
Yes, it's worth okay. It's worth recapping this bit, isn't it?
You did it. So
the Merchant Venturers Charter Day. I managed to secrete myself in, and there were attempts twice to get rid of me by the people who were running the service, but I managed to stay in there and actually record the sermon by Bishop Mike, and it was at. Point in the sermon, he was really, I mean, quite obviously trying to excuse the slave trading of Edward Colston, really to kind of put an ivy leaf, fig leaf, in fact, over the rather nasty profiteering that was Edward Colston did from the slave trade. He actually, the words he was using were to do with his saying his business dealings. There have been criticism of his business dealings, but that criticism is just speculation. And then that was actually covered by the BBC, by the Bristol Post, that he'd said that. So it does seem as if the reason that parents and others are kept out of these services, and only merchant venturers, or maybe teachers from the schools, in the case of the commemoration day, are privy to this. So there seems to be a bit of a sinister motive keeping people out of the cathedral while that service is going on.
Well, I mean, but also I noticed noticed again this year is that the cathedral itself doesn't put this up on its website. What it does put on its website, though, that also apparently happens in November in the cathedral, are the UE graduation ceremonies. So there's a big sign on the website saying that there might be restricted public access on between certain dates, but there was nothing on there about Friday the 6th and the commemoration day. So I had to get that information from the Colston Girls School website, because I know how to find out how schools publish their letters to their parents, and it specifically said in that letter that parents are not invited to go into the commemoration day.
Well, that sounds a bit strange, doesn't it, that you're having a big, if you're commemorating your school, only the children are allowed and not the parents. What's the reason?
I think that's a good question. I think only the school is in a position to say why it is that the parents aren't invited.
Well, we'll have to ask them.
Well, on the day when we were down there, the message that we got back was the cathedral apparently is not big enough.
Well, I don't believe that. I mean, I don't believe that at all. I've seen, in fact, they've had sometimes concerts, etc. there, and services where they're standing room only, and sometimes people sit. Not everybody has to have a chair to sit on, it seems. I mean, I've seen the place absolutely packed out. So anyway, what was going on last Friday? Tell us what was, it was just an ordinary service, was it?
No, it wasn't an ordinary service. So the students that came down from Colston Girls School, they had their full uniform on and they had their hat. And they also, when they got there, their tutors came and gave them a chrysanthemum that they had to put in their lapel. Now, the chrysanthemum apparently was Colston's favourite flower. And there was no other schooling on that day. So the only thing that all of the girls from that school did last Friday was where they were brought down to the cathedral by their parents. They went into the cathedral and they had this ceremony, and then the parents were supposed to be picking them up from the cathedral and then taking them home. That was the only
so
thing.
So they get
happened.
The afternoon off. That's nice.
Well, that was the only thing that happened that day. I read the letter as anybody else could read the letter that was sent out to the parents that is up on the website.
Well, as someone who is a bit of an expert in education, why do you criticise that the way that this is done?
The issue I have is Edward Colston did give the money over, and that school is founded and named because of that particular historical event. I've been inside Colston Girls School. Now, right inside the front doors that are just off Cheltenham Road, there is a copy of the statue that we see on the centre. And there's also a picture, very interestingly, on the wall of Edward Colston. And down in the bottom, it says who it is. It gives the date he was born and the date he died. And underneath it says philanthropist. And what that makes me think, when they then go into the cathedral year after year to remember Edward Colston and what he did for the city and in order to build this school, is this school giving the children that attend there the full picture of what was going on and the historical facts that we know to be true around Edward Colston? And there were a number of people that got involved in last Friday's that are from the Bristol's Radical History Group, and these are academics, a lot of the people that are involved in that group, and so they produced a small leaflet to try to counteract whether the balance story is given by the Colston Girls School in relation to Colston, but if there's anything that's reflective of what goes on generally in the city around Edward Colston, then we're suggesting that it's not.
The leaflet, you've given me a copy of it here. We're Bristol residents concerned about Colston Founder Day and Charter Day ceremonies about to take place in the city's cathedral following public words spoken by the bishop at last year's ceremony that Edward Colston had lived a life of significance, and there may still be some speculation on some of the circumstances around his business roots right here. It's not speculation but fact that the bulk of the money Colston gave away for charitable purposes, in inverted commas, which built two of your schools, was generated off the backs of African slaves working in sugar plantations. Is this charity? Is this philanthropy? You might add. The memory of Africans, mere commodities under slavery, forcibly removed from their West African homelands, branded, their names taken from them, working under the sun, the slave driver lash at their backs, should be remembered whenever the name Colston is mentioned. Colston used his money to court influence and power in the city and parliament. He lends money to the Bristol City Corporation 1 year and becomes a member of the Society of Merchant Venturers the next. Ceremonies held in the cathedral, private or otherwise, presided over by the Bishop of Bristol, with hundreds of Bristol children in attendance, where the Bishop chooses to speculate over this fact and not give dignity to the memory of African ancestors who were dehumanized is perverse. We're using our presence to provide a balance in education. Use the central library next door and the internet to find out the truth about Colston and other Bristol slave traders, the merchant venturers, the slave and sugar trade in Bristol, slave rebellions in Africa, in America and in the Caribbean, and the movement for the abolition of slavery, and also talk to your parents and teachers at school. Now, that's a pretty comprehensive leaflet. Now, these were going out to the children.
Well, there were a couple, you know, we kind of organised ourselves, and as an experienced teacher, the thing I immediately said was, the minute you start giving these out to the children, the teachers are going to get very, very spooked by this. So I said to them, look, if any of the teachers come up to you and start asking you not to do this, send them to me, because I can speak their language. A couple of the people from the Radical History Group went and took that leaflet over to Alistair Perry, who is the executive principal of the Colston Girls Trust. So they kept him occupied. And as I anticipated, within about a minute of some of the girls being given those leaflets, the teachers were getting very, very upset. You could see they were visibly stressed and anxious about the fact that these leaflets were being given out.
Do you think it's a sort of tribal thing amongst staff of these schools, that they don't question the whole Colston business, that they're loyal to the school, because they're, I suppose, worried that their jobs may be at stake if they say the wrong thing?
What I thought about the teachers' staff is that actually they probably have no idea who Edward Colston is, and they certainly probably have no idea how controversial this has been over the decades in this city, and I don't think they've got any idea what happened last year as a result of what the bishop said in the cathedral. Now, if you're local and if you've lived in Bristol for a number of years and you're tuned in to certain things that are going on, then you would have that understanding. But clearly the teachers that I spoke to had no idea. What they were concerned with is the girls not being given these leaflets. And there was a senior member of staff that I spoke to, and she was using the "we are responsible for the girls' safety." And my response was, well, I'm sure you've done a risk assessment about any eventuality that could happen whilst the girls are in a public space, which is where they were. There could have been somebody else giving leaflets out about something else.
Well, yes, and is there anything unsafe about this leaflet?
Absolutely nothing, and that's exactly why the lecturers from the Radical History Group went and spoke to Alistair Perry, their executive principal. He wasn't taking the leaflets out of the girls' hand like some of the teachers were. He wasn't being rude. I said to the woman I spoke to, well, have you read it? And that they were refusing to even read it. And she was saying, I'm responsible for the children's safety, and I need to get them into the cathedral. So I suggested that she better get on with that then. So otherwise the girls are going to get more leaflets.
Well, the interesting thing would be to know what was in the sermon from Bishop Mike this year at these two events. It might probably have been a similar kind of sermon, I would imagine. But did anyone get in to have a listen?
Well, on the Friday, which is the day that I was able to go down there, Cleo did get in. Now, Cleo's involved with St. Paul's Carnival, and I heard you talking about that before 6 o'clock, and kind of that's been well documented over the last couple of weeks. Now, Cleo did go to Colston Girls when that was her school, so she did get in, so she was able to get into the back of the cathedral. But it was quite evident that they were, I mean, we stayed around probably for an hour after the ceremony had started, and pretty much people were guarding the door.
Sounds like a fortress. Not like a cathedral.
Well, you know, I mean, it was quite clear that there was people from within the cathedral were going to be standing by the door, and they weren't going to, they were absolutely not going to let us in there.
This is a public building.
It's a public building, and you know, there were other people outside as well by this point, because, and they were sat waiting to go into the cathedral to have a look around or to do whatever people do in cathedrals.
So, what is Commemoration Day really all about? Is it about the school? Is it about the staff? Or is it about Colston?
Well, I mean, they're commemorating the founding of their school, so they have to talk about Colston, because apparently he was the person that put the money in so that this school could be built. I mean, I think now the next steps actually is to go to the school and start asking the questions about, okay, what exactly are you, you know, how exactly are you presenting this? Where's the balance around Colston and how you're presenting the local history of this city and this particular character that is so controversial, because Bristol's not come to terms with it. That's what it's about.
And what are your thoughts about, and I suppose I'm also asking you secondhand, what Clio makes of the decision by George Ferguson and the Bristol City Council to take away funding from the committee that organises the St Paul's Carnival and start organising that in-house from City Council itself?
I mean, obviously, Clio did share a bit of what's been going on behind the scenes, and I'm not going to break her confidence, but that was the first time I'd met Clio. I'd had a few email exchanges with her about, you know, all going down to give out some balance around Commemoration Day. But clearly, Clio is very, very upset with the decision and is absolutely determined that she's going to try to continue with her other trustees to forge ahead so that something does happen next summer.
Because we've got a problem here, haven't we? We've got an ex-merchant venturer mayor who's saying, well, I don't think the Afro-Caribbeans in the city are capable of organising their own carnival. This is actually, there's a sinister side to this.
Well, exactly. And I mean, the thing is that the people that were down at Commemoration Day, whether they happened to be there because they'd heard that we were going to put a little protest on about the closed cathedral, or whether they were there specifically because Clio had asked them to come down to talk about St Paul's Carnival, everybody understood that these things are part of the same issue.
Tell us a bit about the Radical History Group.
Well, they're a local history group, and they're interested in the history of the forgotten, I suppose, locally. So I came across these guys a few years ago. They give lectures. They looked at the so-called race riots in the city in the early 80s, and what they actually found was there was also urban unrest in different parts of the city, but it just didn't get reported by the media, and therefore it's been forgotten. But they've also done reenactments of kind of what happened in Queen Square in 1832, when the jail was people went into the jail, they attacked the jail. So what they expose is kind of the forgotten history, I suppose, of Bristol, and just about how radical the history of our city actually is.
It is, isn't it?
I
feel quite proud to be a bit of a Bristolian. You know, I'm originally a Londoner, but this is Martin. Maybe bring you on this. Bristol was for many centuries was Britain's second city, really up until roughly the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, I mean, as I said in the first hour, it was changed hands twice in the Civil War because it was a key objective for both sides. And on this question of Colston Girls' School, of course, it used to be a private school and was taken into the public sector. Now, when a private organisation does things like this, we can complain and moan and say, well, that's not really right.
Well, is it fair
but
to
we're
say
actually it's... paying for this as well. So there's an even further point to make. And, of course, the policy on who gets into Colston Girls' School is extremely selective, and we're paying for that too.
Absolutely. I mean, I totally agree with that. Colston Girls serve the exact area that they pretty much have always served. And you ain't going to Colston Girls your child unless you've got the money to get your child to Colston Girls. So if you live within walking distance, that's good. But if you don't live within walking distance and your family haven't got that money year on year, your child is not going there. And that is backdoor social selection. I mean, the other thing I would say actually about this is it's also about the decisions that are being made by the cathedral, because the cathedral, if you look on their website, they make quite a bit about the fact that they're part of the modern day anti-slavery partnership, which is a kind of strategic partnership across the city that involves the police and Unseen, and the diocese, the Clifton Cathedral, Bristol Cathedral is part of this, and there's things inside the cathedral where they're trying to raise awareness about modern day slavery. Well, people are enslaved today for the same reasons as Colston enslaved people, and you know it doesn't fit with me, and I really don't understand how it fits with the people that run the cathedral.
I mean, there's also this economic slavery, Martin, which is starting to. I mean, it's been in many parts of the world for many centuries. I mean, it certainly does look as if in Africa, the original overt military colonialism has been overtaken by the IMF and a kind of economic form of slavery.
Well, yeah, I mean, we could talk about, I mean, any kind of coercion on people is obviously reprehensible, and there are various mechanisms through which it can take place.
But I mean, effectively in Africa, you're talking about financial means being used to starve almost entire nations.
Well, yeah, I mean,
into submission.
You know, many people work in appalling conditions. I mean, just off the top of my head, do people realise that thousands of Chinese coal miners die every year in private sector mines in China, which have no proper health and safety? Is that slavery? I think it could be classified as such, but it's not overtly slavery. They are paid wages. They can't form trade unions because it's a communist country and the trade unions are controlled. But effectively, those people are slaves, if you wanted to. And that's just off the top of my head. All over the world, people are, you know, basically living in appalling conditions. And, you know, what is a slave? But I think the actual chattel slavery of the 18th and 19th centuries is a fairly specific kind of slavery. I mean, the people were actually owned by the people who you know, traded them. But
maybe more a kind of feudal system.
But I still come back to what I was saying earlier. I've got a big question mark. If Colston Girls' School is part of the public sector, which it is, it never used to be, but it now is, perhaps we ought to change the name, change the admissions policy, and put in some new teachers and new managers. What do you think?
Certainly the admissions policy needs to change. There is absolutely no reason why Colston Girls has a free school meal percentage of 12.5% when we know the average across the whole of Bristol is 25%. Lawrence Hill is more like 50%, and Lawrence Hill is within walking distance of Colston Girls School. So something is going on around how that school puts barriers up in front of certain groups of parents so that they're not in a position to negotiate their way in for their child, and that needs to change. The other thing that Colston Girls School does is they ring fence places for girls that don't live in Bristol. We're just about to hit a secondary school place crisis. We need those places for children that live in Bristol, and they're applying. Hundreds and hundreds of parents get refused, and they will quite shortly when the year seven letters are sent out to parents. There will be hundreds of families in Bristol who have put Colston Girls as their preference, and they will be refused. But there will be ring fence places for children that live in Clevedon or Backwell or Almondsbury or wherever that is North Somerset and South Gloucestershire and Baines, because Colston Girls School ring fence those places for children that live there.
Well, this week, we've been talking really about the commemoration day last week for Colston Girls School, but this week was the Merchant Venturers Charter Day, and although it's not been officially announced, as far as I can see, anywhere, I called up the Merchant Venturers office today to find that it's a chap called Tim Ross, who's the new master, who's installed a massive banquet which happens after their service on Tuesday this week, which is the Merchant Venturers Charter Day. It happens annually. And the Bristolian has quite helpfully, this is the local gossip magazine or scandal rag, has quite helpfully done a little bit of digging on Tim Ross, who they say is who seems well versed, they say, in the old venturer trick of turning public money into private wealth. Tim Ross was until June last year chairman of financial basket case waste company May Gurney, which there's been a lot of reporting on, of course, and May Gurney that eventually, I believe, went bankrupt. And certainly that whole waste contract with Bristol City Council had to be cancelled, and it was taken over by Kier Group. And the Bristolian carries on, currently being rescued from financial collapse via a multi-million pound takeover by anti-union construction outfit Kier Group. Indeed, such are the financial problems at May Gurney that Bristol City Council has been discouraged from enforcing any penalty clauses in its waste collection contract with the company, as it was thought it would bankrupt them and our rubbish would just simply go uncollected in the city. However, bankruptcy is not something that's likely to happen to Ross. Once the ink was dry on May Gurney's contract with the City Council, he cashed in 100,000 of his shares in December 2011 to pocket a cool £235,000, conveniently before the share price of the company went south. He scarpered as chairman of May Gurney 6 months later, just a few months before the share price tumbled below a pound. So this gives us an idea, I suppose, of the master of the merchant and what the merchant venture seems to sort of reward as success, Christine.
Well, I mean, I've got no reason to think that what is reported in the Bristolian is in any way not correct.
Is in any way true?
Well, I mean, if it's not true, let Tim Ross sue. You know, I mean, that would be the...
Well, we're certainly one of the things we will do is we'll do as we did last year with Chris Curling, is invite him on to have a chat and tell us about himself and his history, his past. I noticed on the Merchant Venture website, it talks about him being a corporate lawyer in the City of London. Martin, this isn't incredibly surprising, is it?
No, it's not terribly surprising. I think it is interesting that a lot of this money is made at the intersection between public and private sectors. May Gurney basically get contracts for public money to do things, and they've gone bust, just like the care homes we were discussing in the first hour. And that's the way to make money, isn't it? That's the way to make real entrepreneurs don't invent a better widget. They just batten onto the state and make sure that they get that money in their own pockets.
Well, let's just go through Tim's CV a little bit more. Previously, he was a main board director of George Wimpey and other public companies, chairman of Hargreaves Services PLC, and which sounds to me like something to do with Hargreaves Lansdowne, which we've covered several times and got legal letters from on this show. Number of private or venture capital based companies. He's a past governor of Bristol University, president of the Dolphin Society, and trustee of Quartet Community Foundation. He was also chairman of council at Clifton College until 2014.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, the Dolphin Society is another of those Colston kind of time-founded organisations that give the trusts that they you could apply and give to charities. The Quartet Foundation, of course, or anyone who works in the voluntary and community sector in Bristol will understand the Quartet Foundation. They have a large amount of public money.
Well, I'm sure if Tim was here, what he'd say at this point is, well, actually, we give back much more to the city than we take.
Well, I'm sure he would, and I'm sure, Tony, your response to him would be, well, then open your books,
yes,
and get rid of your Royal Charter so that we can actually see that that's true. And who's to say that it's not? But the point is, we're not able to check it. And that's where the suspicion comes. And it's the lack of transparency and it's the lack of openness and the suspicion that builds up around it.
Martin, more and more of basic essential services, public services, are relying on charity and are relying on people like the Quartet Foundation, aren't they?
Well, that's right. And of course, the other thing that happens is through privatisation of public functions like care homes and so on, it creates an income stream for private sector organisations. Now, I would argue if any public money is committed to something, then that should be spent entirely on the purposes for which it was committed, and that there isn't really much of a case for the private sector to be involved. And that people say, well, the private sector is more efficient. I say, phooey. When you've got things like schools, they're not really in competition with each other in that sense. They are public functions, and there's got to be accountability for the spending of public money, whether it's on waste collection, care homes, or education. And what seems to happen is that powerful groups, you know, connected to Colston Girls' School, Merchant Ventures, whatever, are basically subverting the public good and getting away with it, and also patting themselves on the back at the same time.
Just looking at the current list, as it is on the website, of course, this has been updated this week with Tim Ross being made the master of the Merchant Ventures. You've got the way it's effectively organised is you've got a treasurer, which you can forget about for a moment, but you've got junior warden, senior warden, master. So it looks as if what happens is the senior warden is next year's master, the junior warden will be next year. So looking ahead a bit, maybe Cullen McAlpine will be master of the Merchant Ventures in 2 years' time. The other thing I'd say about this, Christine, is it looks a little bit Masonic, doesn't it? You've got your master and you've got your senior warden, junior warden. These are all Masonic ranks.
Well, it's all very hierarchical, isn't it? And you've got to be in there a long time and you've got to be chosen. You know, I mean, who is it that appoints the junior wardens? I mean, there's 80 odd of them that sit on the that are members of the Merchant Venturers. Who decides who the junior warden is and the senior warden and the master? And presumably, if one or other of those people have done something to upset maybe one or other of the Merchant Venturers, they may not become the master next year.
Who knows? Well, we shall certainly see. And we'll invite these particular regularly Tim and certainly Colson Girls School on to discuss this in future editions of the Politics Show. Christine, where can people follow your work online? Because I think, you know, you since you're standing for mayor next May, we should know a little bit more about, you're not just a one-dimensional person that looks at the what's going on at Bristol Cathedral at this time of year, are you?
No, I mean, I'm looking at what's going on Bristol Cathedral because what I'm actually interested in is what's going on in the education sector in our city, and that is that's why I'm standing, because I don't believe that there is the expertise in the city or that there is the historical knowledge and understanding to know that actually this is what's been going on since academisation, and there are connections between some of these academies that people that aren't haven't been really, really close to education wouldn't understand. And if you looked at the websites and you looked at the actual names now that are involved, you wouldn't be able to necessarily see those links. But yeah, I mean, I am standard as well, okay. But that's not why I'm here.
So the main point you make about the academies and the changes over the last few years is?
That be aware that there are links between some academies that don't necessarily show that, and that merchant venturers are heavily involved in both the secondary and increasingly in our primary school sector, and that they're schools that may have been around for many, many years, like Colston Girls' School.
And why not?
What do you mean, and why not?
Why not? Why shouldn't they be involved?
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that they shouldn't be involved, but they need to start making sure that they're serving the cross-section of children that use the state sector, and they don't have 12.5% free school meals when Bristol has an average of 25, and the Cathedral, Bristol Cathedral Choir School doesn't have less than 7% when they're supposed to take from across the city. I would suggest that that's just not happening.
Well, anyway, if you did manage to get into the cathedral either last Friday for Commemoration Day or this Tuesday for Charter Day for the Merchant Venturers, you probably wouldn't have been hearing this.
We'll be right back.
That's from 1991, Prudence Futuri. But very rarely play music on the politics show, but that just seemed to be quite appropriate for the discussion we were having earlier on, and it's quite nice kind of choral techno, I suppose you'd call it. Now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we've had quite a spectacular, for many, certainly for people in Northern Ireland, arrest this week. Bloody Sunday paras may be named, we're told, if they're charged with murder, as a former soldier, 66, is held over the killing of three demonstrators on Bloody Sunday, and he's released on bail this week.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this article here. I wasn't actually aware that this had happened. And it says here that Lieutenant Colonel Derek Wilford, the officer who commanded the paras on Bloody Sunday, vowed to go to jail in contempt of a government-led inquiry into the deaths of 14 demonstrators if his men were named. Now, the suspicion is that in actual fact, Bloody Sunday was not an accidental event, but that it was actually planned, possibly by the British government, possibly by elements within the parachute regiment in collaboration with loyalist politicians and business leaders. So it wasn't just a question of soldiers overreacting and shooting. The shootings went on for over 20 minutes. It wasn't a fusillade of shots. And the suspicion has to be that it wasn't an out-of-control squad of soldiers, but that in actual fact it was a planned massacre.
Well, what does he mean by saying he will go to jail if a particular soldier is named?
This is what makes me laugh, because in actual fact maybe he should be charged with the conspiracy to murder and sent to prison, because that's what we're supposed to do with terrorists and criminals, isn't it? Even if they're called Lieutenant Colonel.
Yeah, and plus almost more important if they're called Lieutenant Colonel.
Well, indeed, like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who ran the British Army's Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland for many years, named by Sir John Stevens as a terrorist.
There's one amazing irony about the parachute regiment's involvement in Bloody Sunday, which I don't think occurs to many people, and that is that the Defence Secretary at the time was Lord Peter Carrington, and Carrington was involved in this battle, wasn't he? The Bridge Too Far battle, the Operation Market Garden, in the Second World War, where the equivalent at the time, which was the British 1st Airborne Division, the paratroopers down at Arnhem, he didn't actually go down the road. He had waited around for 17 hours in his tank until the people at the bridge at Arnhem had finally succumbed to the attack by the Nazis, and at which point the entire battle was lost. So I'm surprised at the way that the relationship really between the paras and Carrington then almost surfaces up again in 1972.
Well, I mean, what goes around comes around, isn't it? The British establishment looks after its own, whether it was in the 1940s or the 1970s.
One of the things I've been told is that even now in the regular army, if there is some sort of meeting or event where both paras and regular army are going to be there, a lot of the regular army people will sometimes turn up a little bit early just so they get the chance to have a dig. The paratroopers will turn up a little bit early so they get a chance to have a dig at the regular army people, saying, yeah, just like Arnhem, you're late again.
Well, that may be so, Tony, and of course the suspicion is that some kind of deal was done by MI6 with the Nazis to throw the battle. I mean, we've covered that on other programmes, and it's a lot of the information about that has been covered by us in previous
On a related subject, Sir John Scarlett from WMD to Wonga, how the former MI6 chief has cashed in. Former MI6 chief Sir John Scarlett, whose evidence helped take us to war in Iraq, has latterly proved to be better at making money than standing up to Tony Blair. The Middle East desk, the Secret Intelligence Service, is not a quiet place. Over 3 days in April last year, Israel suspended peace talks with the Palestinian Authority. 25 people were killed in a series of bomb blasts at Shia rally in Baghdad, and Iraqi helicopters destroyed a convoy of ISIS fuel tankers inside Syria. Such events were once the priority of the former SIF chief, Sir John Scarlett, but over that 72-hour period, the retired spy boss was engaged in a different sort of business. A paid senior advisor to US bank Morgan Stanley, he was in Hawaii at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Maui, along with 100 of the bank's top-performing brokers. At the Kapula Resort, Sir John was on a panel of security and intelligence experts, offering insight into global affairs for those brokers willing to take off time for their golf and deep sea fishing. Martin, from MI6 boss to one of the highest paid jobs in the world in the banking sector.
Well, I believe he also worked for HSBC, did he not? Who, of course, were convicted of laundering money for the Mexican drug cartels, who are themselves in bed with the CIA.
These people are criminals.
That's what my contention is.
James Cusick, political correspondent for The Independent, and came out on Wednesday this week. It's a bit irritating, isn't it, that there seems to be this revolving door between the banksters and the spooks.
Well, it's not at all surprising, is it? You need what the Russians call a krisha, a roof. If you want to steal, you've got to have somebody to protect you. And that's the reality. I believe that there is high-level criminality at the top in this country. And it's related to things like terrorism, VIP paedophilia, and sheer theft and fraud. And basically, we've already got laws against all of this. They're just not enforced, because there's one law for us and another law for that lot.
Well, excellent article this, and I'll link to it on our show page, which is thisweek.org.uk. I'm going to get back later, so you can look that up if you want to tonight. But there are others on this in this article on this list as well, Martin. Sir Richard Dearlove, head of SIS, that's MI6, between 1999 and 2004, he joined the global insurance company American International Group, AIG, shortly after leaving the service, and has advised other large firms on global intelligence. The days of old-school spy chiefs retiring quietly with their pensions to run a homeless charity or a preservation trust appear to be long gone. Also, Lord Carlisle, he said... SC, this is a company called SC Strategy that he's involved with, was a reasonably successful company that provided advice to international clients. However, their only identified client is Qatar's sovereign wealth fund.
And Qatar, of course, have been leading players in sending militants into Syria and Iraq to achieve their political goals, even though there are no democratic elections in Qatar. I think the government of Qatar should go. The government of Qatar should just go. Not next week, tomorrow. And if they don't go, there should be an armed uprising against them, because that's our policy. Those who don't allow democracy, we're going to get the bombs and the bullets out and drive them out. And that is British policy, and we are in alliance with Qatar to pursue that policy.
So how do they decide where regime change is good and where it's bad? Is there any morals?
Well, there's no. It depends whether you're nice to us or not. When the Saudis invade Yemen, that is fine. When the Saudis invade Bahrain, that is fine. When the Russians turn up in Syria, that's bad, but that's just because they're not doing what they want. We have a criminal elite in this country linked to the security services, using paedophilia as a means of blackmail, and intimately linked with Islamist terrorism going back 20 or 30 years. These people should be in prison and their assets should be seized. I don't believe in the death penalty. I believe in life meaning life. When these, if people are convicted of these serious offences, they should be put in prison, and that's where they should stay.
Well, it's 20 years today after the extraordinary Princess Diana panorama interview conducted by Martin Bashir. Martin, that was also, what people may not realise, is that there was basically a complete security lockdown at the BBC over that interview, because they were quite rightly concerned that royal lawyers would serve an injunction on the BBC to stop its transmission. And so in the papers 20 years ago, all there was an anonymous in the newspapers, also in Radio Times and online, all there was a very anonymous entry for Panorama that night. So it is just Panorama, which is an investigative documentary, so that the royal lawyers didn't get any kind of warning that it was going to be Diana appearing. So what do the spooks think about her death? Well, we know one spook, at least Martin and I do, reasonably well. That's Annie Machon. So what's the significance of having people like Annie able to talk about this kind of thing, Martin?
Well, because she's been inside MI5 and worked there for, I think, 14 years. She's got a knowledge from the inside which others from the outside won't have. And, of course, she's very much of the same opinion as us about many of the things we talk about on this programme.
But why so few whistleblowers?
Well, presumably people know which side their bread's buttered on. I mean, you know, her career with MI5 went down the drain when she blew the whistle on their involvement, or the MI6's involvement in attempts to kill Colonel Gaddafi using the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who are Al-Qaeda Libya. And you know what? We armed, trained and directed them to attempt to kill Gaddafi back in the 90s and to overthrow the government of Libya in the recent past. They are Al-Qaeda and they are our allies.
But there are also other occasions, aren't there, where people who are working very closely with security services or directly for them, like David Kelly in the run-up to the Iraq war, and also Gareth Williams, the GCHQ cryptographer, end up dying mysterious deaths.
Well, the idea that these guys are basically protecting us from terrorism is, to my mind, laughable. Given the modern technologies we have and the internet research that people are able to carry out, and we always say in this program, if you don't believe us, go and make your own research. The evidence that these people are involved in terrorism are going back decades is overwhelming, frankly.
So let's have a listen now to former MI5 officer Annie Machon with her thoughts about the timing of the death of Princess Diana.
It was interesting timing. The reason I want to raise this particularly with personal experience of the case, I mean, I know there's all sorts of speculation about what really happened and was Henri Paul drunk and, you know, why they took the route they did. It was completely circuitous. But David and I had personal involvement in it. Apart from the timing, which really screwed our lives over for about a year afterwards, about 2 months after her death, we had a mysterious phone call. And it turned out it was Mohammed Al-Fayed, who wanted us to go to Paris and look at some documents he'd been offered. So, at this point, we're living in a very remote farmhouse. Black Ritz Mercedes comes to pick us up and take us to Paris, and almost crashes twice, so that could have been a good headline. Anyway, we look at the documents. He's been offered these for sale from a guy who's very vague about how he got hold of them.
Oswald de Winter.
That's the one. These are documents purporting to prove that there was CIA and MI6 involvement in Diana's death. And they looked good, but if you knew what an insight, what a document really looked like, what a proper MI6 document looked like, there were some simple errors, things like the date timeline, things like the addressee list, things, they just weren't quite right. They were forgeries, they were very good forgeries. And this would have been a classic straw man technique. You know, Al-Fayed was asked for $20 million for these documents and probably would have paid if they were real, because he was desperate to prove that there was a plot against his son and his possible future daughter-in-law. Anyway, we saw that they were forgeries, they were fakes, and it saved him $20 million, but also saved him embarrassment. This would have been a classic straw man operation, whereby he would have bought them, held them up to the world's media and said, look, I've got proof. And then the authorities would have turned around and said, ah, look, so obvious, look at these simple errors, of course they're forgeries. You can imagine what would have happened. Anything else he ever found out, he would have been dismissed as a fantasist. So, you know, his entire campaign for justice for his son would have stalled pretty much before it started. Anyway, as the lady down there said, the guy who was trying to flog him these documents was a well-known con man called Oswald or Oscar Le Winter. He was also notoriously an MI6 agent. He was quite well known. Most agents were pretty, you know, tightly, their identities were quite tightly held. He was pretty well known, though, because he seemed to get involved in all sorts of dodgy activities. So that, to us, proved that there was an MI6 interest in this. And then, of course, we started looking at the other evidence and all the rest of it. And I have to say, my personal opinion, I think, yes, they did intend to at least seriously injure or kill her. And it's not just about the fact that, was she pregnant, wasn't she? We'll never know, because they embalmed her against all French law so quickly. And all the other speculative things you see in the press, it's also the fact that it was reported that she was being a great success in the landmine campaign that she was running.
Yes.
But also, she was about to go into campaigning on the behalf of the Palestinians. Wow. Now, you can imagine someone of Princess Diana's profile doing that. They would not have tolerated it. They could not have dealt with that. So I think that's why she was taken out. I think they'd probably been planning it for a while, and it was just perfect timing. They did it when they did.
That was the former MI5 officer Annie Mash on there speaking about the death of Princess Diana. What do you make of this Palestinian angle that she puts quite a lot of weight on there, Martin?
Well, I listen carefully to what she says and I generally respect her opinion. I mean, inevitably, we're reduced to a certain amount of speculation. We don't know exactly what they get up to, but do they go around assassinating people? Hell yes.
Also, just within the last week or so, there's been more evidence that the Israeli troops are actually harvesting the organs of dead Palestinians, that is to say people who are dying one way or another, but particularly in live conflicts with the Israeli Defence Force.
Well, I mean, lots and lots of Palestinians have been executed out of hand in the last few weeks, and we hardly notice because we have what I call propaganda, so that we're told in great length about the iniquities of the Syrian government or whatever, but what Israel gets up to or what Saudi Arabia gets up to is, you know, in page 10 of the serious newspapers in a one-inch column. And that gives people a very distorted view of what really is going on in the world and what the real problems actually are.
What about US foreign policy? Israel still have quite a stronghold over it?
Absolutely. There's been some spats between Obama and Netanyahu, but in many respects, that's quite clear that the Republican candidates, for example, for president of the US, are virtually 100% behind whatever the Israelis decide to do. And they bend over backwards to make everybody know it.
Well, fanatical loyalty, control freakery and vast wealth going back centuries. I spoke a couple of weeks ago to the Australian Diana assassination author John Morgan about what he believes as a British royal family is a cult.
Yeah, well, there's two books really. Paris London Connection, The Assassination of Princess Diana. That book is a real short summary. It's less than 200 pages. It's a fast, easy read book. And then the second book, which I only just finished last year before it was too late, and that's called How They Murdered Princess Diana, The Shocking Truth. You know, that book is an 800 page book, but it's also a narrative and easy to read book, and it covers a lot of the evidence. So whereas the short book doesn't cover the evidence, this book does include a lot of the evidence. It's hard to come away from reading that second book without understanding that something drastically bad went on and who was involved. It really is a forensic analysis. Six of them, I've written 10 books on the death of Princess Diana. Six of them are detailed forensic inspects of the crash and the events surrounding it. And I couldn't have written that last book unless I'd done those six volumes. That last book puts them all together. So, you know, I'm quite pleased with the work I've done, and I'm pleased that people from reading the books are learning what happened. And it's been a huge cover-up. There's massive forces trying to cover this up. So I'm pleased that I've had a role in that.
Just give us an idea of something that you investigated before the whole Diana case landed on your plate.
Yeah, I was brought up in a fundamentalist religious cult, Christian cult. So I wrote a book about that called Flying Free. It helped me to fly free because I was in it for 35 years, so it had a huge impact on my life. So I do have a sort of interest in the truth because I can see how the truth got suppressed in that cult, and I can see it happens in other organisations.
So do you think there's a cult-like aspect to the royal family?
Yeah, I absolutely feel that it's run like a cult. Yeah, it is, I think. It's a very pressurised system. Diana was sort of, you just can't imagine how difficult it is for someone in her position. The way she was set up with the marriage of Charles, the complete failure of the third person in the marriage, and Camilla, and just the pressure that was on her with the media constantly following her every move, and just going through the dreadful.
I mean, what are the characteristics of a cult? How would you single it out from another, say, a golf club or something?
Yeah, it's mind control, really. It's brainwashing. I mean, you know, what happens is you can't leave a cult. That's one of the key things, I suppose, that you can't. Most cults, you can't leave them, you know. Whether religious, they'll say, well, you'll end up in hellfire. And the thing is that this sounds, to a person who hasn't been in a cult, they can't understand it, but it sounds sort of ridiculous. But the thing is that when you're in a cult or you're brought up in it, like someone in the royal family is, then you absolutely believe it. You believe it to every fibre of your body, you believe what you've told. So if you believe that you're going to end up in hellfire if you leave the cult, you won't leave it. That's what the issue is, I suppose. It's mind control. Whereas a golf club will let you have different thoughts. Basically, your thoughts are controlled when you're in a cult.
Someone's got to be running these cults.
Yeah, they're mainly crooks, unfortunately. Yeah, and they're con men, con women. There's a formula. There's a formula for cults, and most of them are pretty similar when you study them. And I did study them when I did that book.
That's Australian author and Republican John Morgan there, and his book, main probably the most easy accessible, is The Paris-London Connection, about the death of Princess Diana. Finally, Martin, just a couple of minutes, but we've got one big story this week that's hardly been covered at all in the British press. That's the biggest ever strike by Lufthansa. 500,000 people affected, but hardly covered in the news here at all.
Well, I guess it comes back to what I was saying earlier about propaganda. We are given a diet of things we're supposed to be concerned about, and other things which are equally or more important are hardly ever mentioned. And I'm glad to see that the German workers are asserting themselves. We need a progressive force in Germany to try and reform the EU, but not in the direction that Cameron wants to reform.
Why is the British press, the London media, so reluctant to report any of this?
Well, the classic way that all strikes are reported is that the strike itself is reported, but what it's about isn't reported.
But there's been almost nothing about this one. Anyway, the other thing this week, biggie, is the doping crisis. Apparently the Russians are no good at athletics. They've got to go.
Well, it just is very suspicious, isn't it? I'm quite sure there probably is doping going on in Russia. There's doping going on all over the place. But why the Russians and why now? I think that it's part of the geopolitical war game that we're involved in.
Thanks, Martin. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Now, it's just a show dialect. We're hoping it will be back soon. And on this week's podcast, you can hear from Snowden fan and crypto party hostess Silky Carlo how to make your laptop as private as possible. Also from Maz, the daughter of Birmingham terrorist murder victim Mohammed Salim. Online at dialectradio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Bristol's Green Party mayor candidate Tony Dyer, also another mayor candidate Christine Townsend. Thanks also to Martin Summers. Also thisweek.org.uk takes us straight to this show links and archives. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Live the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, our